Liz dropped the telephone and put her hands to her ears. Bobby looked at her with growing horror. Carol turned to him. Fresh tears were rolling down her cheeks. There was knowing in her eyes. Knowing. The kind Bobby thought that he had felt while Mr. McQuown had been trying to fool him.
"They chased her," Carol said. "When she tried to leave, they chased her and made her come back."
Bobby knew. They had chased her down a hotel corridor. He had seen it. He couldn't remember where, but he had.
"Make them stop doing it. Make me stop seeing it," Carol screamed. "She's hitting them, but she can't get away. She's hitting them, but she can't get away."
Ted tipped the table out of his lap and struggled to his feet. His eyes were blazing. "Hug her, Carol. Hug her tight. That will make it stop." Carol threw her good arm around Bobby's mother. Liz staggered backward a step, almost falling when one of her shoes hooked the leg of the sofa. She stayed up, but the telephone tumbled to the rug beside one of Bobby's outstretched sneakers, burring harshly. For a moment, things stayed that way. It was as if they were playing statues, and it had just yelled, "Freeze!" It was Carol who moved first, releasing Liz Garfield's waist and stepping back. Her sweaty hair hung in her eyes. Ted went toward her and reached out to put a hand on her shoulder. "Don't touch her," Liz said, but she spoke mechanically, without force. Whatever had flashed inside her at the sight of the child on Ted Brodigan's lap had faded a little, at least temporarily. She looked exhausted. Nonetheless, Ted dropped his hand. "You're right," he said. Liz took a deep breath, held it, let it out. She looked at Bobby, then away. Bobby wished with all his heart that she would put her hand out to him, help him a little, help him get up, just that. But she turned to Carol instead. Bobby got to his feet on his own. "What happened here?" Liz asked Carol. Although she was still crying and her words kept hitching as she struggled for breath, Carol told Bobby's mom about how the three big boys had found her in the park, and how at first it had seemed like just another one of their jokes, a bit meaner than most, but still just a joke. Then Harry had really started hitting her, while the others held her. The popping sound in her shoulders scared them, and they ran away. She told Liz how Bobby had found her 5 or 10 minutes later. She didn't know how long, because the pain had been so bad and carried her up here. And how Ted had fixed her arm after giving her Bobby's belt to catch the pain with. She bent, picked up the belt, and showed Liz the tiny tooth marks in it with a mixture of pride and embarrassment. "I didn't catch all of it, but I caught a lot." Liz only glanced at the belt before turning to Ted. "Why'd you tear her top off, Chief?"
"It's not torn," Bobby cried. He was suddenly furious with her. "He cut it off so he could look at her shoulder and fix it without hurting her. I brought him the scissors, for cripes sake. Why are you so stupid, Mom? Why can't you see?"
She swung without turning, catching Bobby completely by surprise. The back of her open hand connected with the side of his face, her forefinger actually poked into his eye, sending a zag of pain deep into his head. His tears stopped, as if the pump controlling them had suddenly shorted out. "Don't you call me stupid, Bobby-o," she said. "Not on your ever-loving tintype." Carol was looking fearfully at the hook-nosed witch who had come back in a taxi wearing Mrs. Garfield's clothes. Mrs. Garfield, who had run, and who had fought when she couldn't run anymore. But in the end, they had taken what they wanted from her. "You shouldn't hit Bobby," Carol said. "He's not like those men."
"Is he your boyfriend?" she laughed. "Yeah, good for you. But I'll let you in on a secret, sweetheart. He's just like his daddy, and your daddy, and all the rest of them. Go in the bathroom, I'll clean you up and find you something to wear. Christ, what a mess."
Carol looked at her a moment longer, then turned and went into the bathroom. Her bare back looked small and vulnerable, and white, so white in contrast to her brown arms. "Carol," Ted called after her. Is it better now? Bobby didn't think he was talking about her arm. Not this time. Yes, she said without turning, but I can still hear her. Far away. She's screaming. Who's screaming? Liz asked. Carol didn't answer her. She went into the bathroom and closed the door. Liz looked at it for a moment, as if to make sure Carol wasn't going to pop back out again, then turned to Ted. Who's screaming? Ted only looked at her warily, as if expecting another ICBM attack at any moment. Liz began to smile. It was a smile Bobby knew, her I'm-losing-my-temper smile. Was it possible she had any left to lose? With her black eyes, broken nose, and swollen lip, the smile made her look horrid. Not his mother, but some lunatic. Quite the Good Samaritan, aren't you? How many feels did you cop while you were fixing her up? She hasn't got much, but I bet you checked what you could, didn't you? Never miss an opportunity, right? Come on and fess up to your mama. Bobby looked at her with growing despair. Carol had told her everything, all of the truth, and it made no difference. No difference. God. There is a dangerous adult in this room, Ted said, but it isn't me. She looked, first uncomprehending, then incredulous, then furious. How dare you? How dare you?
He didn't do anything, Bobby screamed. Didn't you hear what Carol said? Didn't you shut your mouth, she said, not looking at him. She looked only at Ted. The cops are going to be very interested in you, I think. Don called Hartford on Friday before I asked him to. He has friends there. You never worked for the state of Connecticut, not in the office of the comptroller, not anywhere else. You were in jail, weren't you?
In a way, I suppose I was, Ted said. He seemed calmer now, in spite of the blood flowing down the side of his face. He took the cigarettes out of his shirt pocket, looked at them, put them back. But not the kind you're thinking of. And not in this world, Bobby thought.
What was it for, she asked, making little girls feel better in the first degree?
I have something valuable, Ted said. He reached up and tapped his temple. The finger he tapped with came away dotted with blood. There are others like me, and there are people whose job it is to catch us, keep us, and use us for, well, use us. Leave it at that. I and two others escaped. One was caught. One was killed. Only I remain free, if that is, he looked around, you call this freedom.
You're crazy. Crazy old Bradigan, nuttier than a holiday fruitcake. I'm calling the police. Let them decide if they want to put you back in the jail you broke out of or in Danbury Asylum. She bent, reached over for the spilled phone. No, Mom, Bobby said and reached for it. Don't.
Bobby, no,
Ted said sharply. Bobby pulled back, looking first at his mom as she scooped up the phone, then at Ted. Not as she is now, Ted told him. As she is now, she can't stop biting. Liz Garfield gave Ted a brilliant, almost unspeakable smile. Good try, you bastard, and took the receiver off the cradle.
What's happening? Cried Carol from the bathroom. Can I come out now?
Not yet, darling, Ted called back. A little longer. Liz poked the telephone's cut-off buttons up and down. She stopped, listened, seemed satisfied. She began to dial. We're going to find out who you are, she said. She spoke in a strange, confiding tone. That should be pretty interesting, and what you've done. That might be even more interesting. If you call the police, they'll also find out who you are and what you've done, Ted said. She stopped dialing and looked at him. It was a cunning sideways stare Bobby had never seen before. What in God's name are you talking about? A foolish woman who should have chosen better. A foolish woman who had seen enough of her boss to know better. Who had overheard him and his cronies often enough to know better. To know that any seminar they attended mostly had to do with booze and sex parties, maybe a little reefer as well. A foolish woman who let her greed overwhelm her good sense.
What do you know about being alone? She cried. I have a son to raise.
She looked at Bobby as if remembering the son she had to raise for the first time in a little while. "How much of this do you want him to hear?" Ted asked.
"You don't know anything. You can't."
"I know everything. The question is, how much do you want Bobby to know? How much do you want the neighbors to know? If the police come and take me, they'll know what I know. That I promise you."
He paused. His pupils remained steady, but his eyes seemed to grow.
"I know everything. Believe me, don't put it to the test."
"Why would you hurt me that way?"
"Given the choice, I wouldn't. You have been hurt enough. By yourself as well as by others. Let me leave. That's all I'm asking you to do. I was leaving anyway. Let me leave. I did nothing but try to help."
"Oh, yes," she said and laughed. "Help. Her sitting on you practically naked. Help."
"I would help you if I..."
"Oh, yeah, and I know how."
She laughed again.
Bobby started to speak and saw Ted's eyes warning him not to. Behind the bathroom door, water was now running into the sink. Liz lowered her head, thinking. At last, she raised it again. "All right," she said. "Here's what I'm going to do. I'll help Bobby's little girl friend get cleaned up. I'll give her an aspirin and find something for her to wear home. While I'm doing those things, I'll ask her a few questions. If the answers are the right answers, you can go. Good riddance to bad rubbish."
"Mom!"
Liz held up a hand like a traffic cop, silencing him. She was staring at Ted, who was looking back at her. "I'll walk her home. I'll watch her go through her front door. What she decides to tell her mother is between the two of them. My job is to see her home, safe, that's all. When it's done, I'll walk down to the park and sit in the shade for a little while. I had a rough night last night." She drew in breath and let it out in a dry and rueful sigh. "Very rough. So I'll go to the park and sit in the shade and think about what comes next, how I'm going to keep him and me out of the poorhouse. If I find you still here when I get back from the park, sweetheart, I will call the police, and don't you put that to the test. Say whatever you want. None of it's going to matter much to anyone if I say I walked into my apartment a few hours sooner than you expected and found you with your hand inside an 11-year-old girl's shorts." Bobby stared at his mother in silent shock. She didn't see the stare. She was still looking at Ted, her swollen eyes fixed on him intently. "If, on the other hand, I came back and you're gone, bag and baggage, I won't have to call anyone or say anything. Tout fini." "I'll go with you," Bobby thought at Ted. "I don't care about the low men. I'd rather have 1,000 low men in yellow coats looking for me, 1,000,000, than have to live with her anymore. I hate her."
"Well," Liz asked, "it's a deal. I'll be gone in an hour, probably less."
"No," Bobby cried. When he'd awakened this morning, he had been resigned to Ted's going, sad but resigned. Now it hurt all over again, worse than before even. "No."
"Be quiet," his mother said, still not looking at him. "It's the only way, Bobby, you know that." Ted looked up at Liz. "Take care of Carol. I'll talk to Bobby."
"You're in no position to give orders," Liz said. But she went. As she crossed to the bathroom, Bobby saw she was limping. A heel had broken off one of her shoes, but he didn't think that was the only reason she couldn't walk right. She knocked briefly on the bathroom door and then, without waiting for a response, slipped inside. Bobby ran across the room, but when he tried to put his arms around Ted, the old man took his hands, squeezed them once briefly, and then put them against Bobby's chest and let go.
"Take me with you," Bobby said fiercely. "I'll help you look for them. 2 sets of eyes are better than 1. Take me with you."
"I can't do that, but you can come with me as far as the kitchen, Bobby. Carol isn't the only one who needs to do some cleaning up."
Ted rose from the chair and swayed on his feet for a moment. Bobby reached out to steady him, and Ted once more pushed his hand gently but firmly away. It hurt. Not as much as his mother's failure to help him up, or even look at him, after she had thrown him against the wall, but enough. He walked with Ted to the kitchen, not touching him, but close enough to grab him if he fell.
Ted didn't fall. He looked at the hazy reflections of himself in the window over the sink, sighed, then turned on the water. He wet the dishcloth and began to wipe the blood off his cheek, checking his window reflection every now and then for reference. "Your mother needs you more now than she ever has before," he said. "She needs someone she can trust."
"She doesn't trust me. I don't think she even likes me."
Ted's mouth tightened, and Bobby understood he had struck upon some truth Ted had seen in his mother's mind. Bobby knew she didn't like him. He knew that. So why were the tears threatening again? Ted reached out for him, seemed to remember that this was a bad idea, and went back to work with the dishcloth instead. "All right," he said. "Perhaps she doesn't like you. If that's true, it isn't because of anything you did. It's because of what you are. A boy," he said bitterly, "a fucking boy. And your father's son, don't forget that. But Bobby, whether she likes you or not, she loves you." "Such a greeting card that sounds, I know, but it's true. She loves you and she needs you. You're what she has. She's badly hurt right now."
"Getting hurt was her own fault," he burst out. "She knew something was wrong. You said so yourself. She's known for weeks, months. But she wouldn't leave that job. She knew, and she still went with him to Providence. She went with him anyway."
"A lion tamer knows, but he still goes into the cage. He goes in because that's where his paycheck is."
"She's got money."
Bobby almost spat. "Not enough, apparently."
"She'll never have enough,"
Bobby said, and knew it was the truth as soon as it was out of his mouth. "She loves you."
"I don't care. I don't love her."
"But you do. You will. You must. It is Ka."
"Ka? What's that?"
"Destiny."
Ted had gotten most of the blood out of his hair. He turned off the water and made one final check of his ghost image in the window. Beyond it lay all of that hot summer, younger than Ted Brodigan would ever be again, younger than Bobby would ever be again, for that matter.
"Ka is destiny." "Do you care for me, Bobby?"
"You know I do," Bobby said, beginning to cry again. Lately, crying was all he seemed to do. His eyes ached from it, lots and lots.
"Then try to be your mother's friend. For my sake, if not your own, stay with her and help this hurt of hers to heal, and every now and then I'll send you a postcard."
They were walking back into the living room again. Bobby was starting to feel a little bit better, but he wished Ted could have put his arm around him. He wished that more than anything. The bathroom door opened. Carol came out first, looking down at her own feet with uncharacteristic shyness. Her hair had been wetted, combed back, and rubber-banded into a ponytail. She was wearing one of Bobby's mother's old blouses. It was so big it came almost down to her knees like a dress. You couldn't see her red shorts at all. "Go out on the porch and wait," Liz said. "Okay. You won't go walking home without me, will you?" "No," Carol said, and her downcast face filled with alarm. "Good. Stand right by my suitcases." Carol started out to the foyer, then turned back. "Thanks for fixing my arm, Ted. I hope you don't get in trouble for it. I didn't want to go out on the damn porch," Liz snapped.
"Anyone to get in trouble," Carol finished in a tiny voice, almost the whisper of a mouse in a cartoon.
Then she went out, Liz's blouse flapping around her in a way that would have been comical on another day. Liz turned to Bobby, and when he got a good look at her, his heart sank. Her fury had been refreshed. A bright red flush had spread over her bruised face and down her neck. "Oh, cripes, what now?" Bobby thought. Then she held up the green key fob, and he knew.
"Where'd you get this, Bobby O?"
"It..." But he could think of nothing to say. No fib, no outright lie, not even the truth.
Suddenly Bobby felt very tired. The only thing in the world he wanted to do was creep into his bedroom and hide under the covers of his bed and go to sleep. I gave it to him, Ted said mildly, yesterday. You took my son to a bookie joint in Bridgeport, a poker parlor in Bridgeport? It doesn't say bookie joint on the key fob, Bobby thought. It doesn't say poker parlor either, because those things are against the law. She knows what goes on there, because my father went there. And like father, like son. That's what they say. Like father, like son. I took him to a movie, Ted said. Village of the Damned at the Criterion. While he was watching, I went to the corner pocket to do an errand.
What sort of errand?
I placed a bet on a prize fight. For a moment, Bobby's heart sank even lower, and he thought, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you lie if you knew how she felt about stuff like that? But he did know. Of course he did.
A bet on a prize fight?
She nodded.
Uh-huh. You left my son alone in a Bridgeport movie theater so you could go make a bet on a prize fight. She laughed wildly. Oh, well, I suppose I should be grateful, shouldn't I? You brought him such a nice souvenir. If he decides to ever make a bet himself or lose his money playing poker like his father did, he'll know where to go.
I left him for 2 hours in a movie theater, Ted said. You left him with me. He seems to have survived both, hasn't he? Liz looked for a moment as if she had been slapped, then for a moment as if she would cry. Then her face smoothed out and became expressionless. She curled her fist around the green key fob and slipped it into her dress pocket. Bobby knew he would never see it again. He didn't mind. He didn't want to see it again.
Bobby, go in your room, she said. No. Bobby, go in your room. No, I won't.
Standing in a bar of sunlight on the welcome mat by Liz Garfield's suitcases, floating in Liz Garfield's old blouse, Carol began to cry at the sound of the raised voices. Go in your room, Bobby, Ted said quietly. I have enjoyed meeting you and knowing you.
Knowing you,
Bobby's mom said in an angry, insinuating voice, but Bobby didn't understand her, and Ted took no notice of her. Go in your room, he repeated.
Will you be all right? You know what I mean?
Yes. Ted smiled, kissed his fingers, and blew the kiss toward Bobby. Bobby caught it and made a fist around it, holding it tight. I'm going to be just fine. Bobby walked slowly toward his bedroom door, his head down and his eyes on the toes of his sneakers. He was almost there when he thought, I can't do this. I can't. Let him go like this. He ran to Ted, threw his arms around him, and covered his face with kisses. Forehead, cheeks, chin, lips, the thin and silky lids of his eyes.
Ted, I love you.
Ted gave up and hugged him tight. Bobby could smell a ghost of the lather he shaved with and the stronger aroma of his Chesterfield cigarettes. They were smells he would carry with him a long time, as he would the memories of Ted's big hands touching him, stroking his back, cupping the curve of his skull. Bobby, I love you too, he said.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Liz nearly screamed.
Bobby turned toward her, and what he saw was Don Biderman pushing her into a corner. Somewhere the Benny Goodman Orchestra was playing 1 o'clock jump on a hi-fi turned all the way up. Mr. Biderman had his hand out as if to slap. Mr. Biderman was asking her if she wanted a little more. Was that the way she liked it? She could have a little more if that was the way she liked it. Bobby could almost taste her horrified understanding.
You really didn't know, did you? He said.
At least not all of it. All they wanted. They thought you did, but you didn't. Go in your room right now, or I'm calling the police and telling them to send a squad car, his mother said. I'm not joking, Bobby-o. I know you're not, Bobby said. He went into his bedroom and closed the door. He thought at first he was all right, and then he thought that he was going to throw up or faint or do both. He walked across to his bed on tottery, unstable legs. He only meant to sit on it, but he lay back on it crosswise instead, as if all the muscles had gone out of his stomach and back. He tried to lift his feet up, but his legs only lay there, the muscles gone from them too. He had a sudden image of Sully John in his bathing suit, climbing the ladder of a swimming float, running to the end of the board, diving off. He wished he was with SJ now. Anywhere but here. Anywhere but here. Anywhere at all but here. When Bobby woke up, the light in his room had grown dim, and when he looked at the floor, he could barely see the shadow of the tree outside his window. He had been out, asleep or unconscious, for 3 hours, maybe four. He was covered with sweat, and his legs were numb. He had never pulled them up onto the bed. Now he tried, and the burst of pins and needles which resulted almost made him scream. He slid onto the floor instead, and the pins and needles ran up his thighs to his crotch. He sat with his knees up around his ears, his back throbbing, his legs buzzing, his head cottony. Something terrible had happened, but at first he couldn't remember what. As he sat there, propped against the bed, looking across at Clayton Moore in his Lone Ranger mask, it began to come back. Carol's arm dislocated, his mother beaten up and half crazy as well, shaking that green key fob in his face, furious with him. And Ted. Ted would be gone by now. And that was probably for the best, but how it hurt to think of. He got to his feet and walked twice around the room. The second time he stopped at the window and looked out, rubbing his hands together at the back of his neck, which was stiff and sweaty. A little way down the street, the Sigsby twins, Dinah and Diane, were jumping rope, but the other kids had gone in either for supper or for the night. A car slid by, showing its parking lights. It was even later than he had at first thought. Heavenly shades of night were falling. He made another circuit of his room, working the tingles out of his legs, feeling like a prisoner pacing his cell. The door had no lock on it, no more than his mom's did, but he felt like a jailbird just the same. He was afraid to go out. She hadn't called him for supper. And although he was hungry, a little anyway, he was afraid to go out. He was afraid of how he might find her, or of not finding her at all. Suppose she had decided she'd finally had enough of Bobby-O, stupid, lying little Bobby-O, his father's son. Even if she was here and seemingly back to normal, was there even such a thing as normal? People had terrible things behind their faces sometimes. He knew that now. When he reached the closed door of his room, he stopped. There was a scrap of paper lying there. He bent and picked it up. There was still plenty of light, and he could read it easily. "Dear Bobby, by the time you read this, I'll be gone. But I'll take you with me in my thoughts. Please love your mother, and remember that she loves you. She was afraid and hurt and ashamed this afternoon, and when we see people that way, we see them at their worst. I have left you something in my room. I will remember my promise. All my love, Ted." The postcards, that's what he promised, to send me postcards. Feeling better, Bobby folded up the note Ted had slipped into his room before leaving and opened his bedroom door. The living room was empty, but it had been set to rights. It looked almost okay if you didn't know there was supposed to be a sunburst clock on the wall beside the TV. Now there was just a little screw where it had hung, jutting out and holding nothing. Bobby realized he could hear his mother snoring in her room. She always snored, but this was a heavy snore, like an old person or a drunk snoring in a movie. That's because they hurt her, Bobby thought. And for a moment he thought of, how you doing, sport? How's a boy, Mr. Biterman, and the two Nimrods elbowing each other in the back seat and grinning, kill the pig, cut her throat, Bobby thought. He didn't want to think it, but he did. He tiptoed across the living room as quietly as Jack in the Giant's castle opened the door to the foyer and went out. He tiptoed up the first flight of stairs, walking on the banister side, because he'd read in one of the Hardy Boys mysteries that if you walked that way, the stairs didn't creak so much, and ran up the second. Ted's door stood open. The room beyond it was almost empty. The few things of his own he'd put up, a picture of a man fishing at sunset, a picture of Mary Magdalene washing Jesus' feet, a calendar, were gone. The ashtray on the table was empty, but sitting beside it was one of Ted's carry-handle bags. Inside it were four paperback books. Animal Farm, The Night of the Hunter, Treasure Island, and Of Mice and Men. Written on the side of the paper bag in Ted's shaky but completely legible handwriting was, "Read the Steinbeck first." "Guys like us," George says when he tells Lenny the story Lenny always wants to hear. "Who are guys like us? Who were they to Steinbeck? Who are they to you?" Ask yourself this. Bobby took the paperbacks but left the bag. He was afraid that if his mom saw one of Ted's carry-handled bags, she would go crazy all over again. He looked in the refrigerator and saw nothing but a bottle of French's mustard and a box of baking soda. He closed the fridge again and looked around. It was as if no one had ever lived here at all, except he went to the ashtray, held it to his nose, and breathed in deeply. The smell of Chesterfields was strong, and it brought Ted back completely. Ted sitting here at his table and talking about Lord of the Flies, Ted standing at his bathroom mirror, shaving with that scary razor of his, listening through the open door, as Bobby read him opinion pieces Bobby himself didn't understand. Ted leaving one final question on the side of a paper bag. Guys like us. Who are guys like us? Bobby breathed in again, sucking up little flakes of ash and fighting back the urge to sneeze, holding the smell in, fixing it in his memory as best he could, closing his eyes, and in through the window came the endless, ineluctable cry of Bowser, now calling down the dark like a dream. Roof, 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 roof. He put the ashtray down again. The urge to sneeze had passed. I'm going to smoke Chesterfields, he decided. I'm going to smoke them all my life. He went back downstairs, holding the paperbacks in front of him and walking on the outside of the staircase again as he went from the second floor to the foyer. He slipped into the apartment, tiptoed across the living room, his mother was still snoring louder than ever, and into his bedroom. He put the books under his bed, deep under. If his mom found them, he would say Mr. Burton had given them to him. That was a lie, but if he told the truth, she'd take the books away. Besides, lying no longer seemed so bad. Lying might become a necessity. In time, it might even become a pleasure. What next? The rumble in his stomach decided him. A couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were next. He started for the kitchen, tiptoeing past his mother's partly open bedroom door without even thinking about it, then paused. She was shifting around on her bed. Her snores had become ragged, and she was talking in her sleep. It was a low, moaning talk Bobby couldn't make out, but he realized he didn't have to make it out. He could hear her anyway. And he could see stuff. Her thoughts, her dreams. Whatever it was awful. He managed three more steps toward the kitchen, then caught a glimpse of something so terrible. His breath froze in his throat like ice.
Have you seen Brodigan? He is an old mongrel, but we love him.
No, he whispered. Oh, Mom.
No.
He didn't want to go in there where she was, but his feet turned in that direction anyway. He went with them like a hostage. He watched his hand reach out, the fingers spread and push her bedroom door open all the way. Her bed was still made. She lay on top of the coverlet in her dress, one leg drawn up so her knee almost touched her chest. He could see the top of her stocking and her garter, and that made him think of the lady in the calendar picture at the corner pocket, the one getting out of the car with most of her skirt in her lap, except the lady getting out of the Packard hadn't had ugly bruises above the top of her stocking. Liz's face was flushed where it wasn't bruised. Her hair was matted with sweat. Her cheeks were smeary with tears and gooey with makeup. A board creaked under Bobby's foot as he stepped into the room. She cried out, and he froze, sure her eyes would open. Instead of awakening, she rolled away from him toward the wall. Here, in her room, the jumble of thoughts and images coming out of her was no clearer, but ranker. And more pungent, like sweat pouring off a sick person. Running through everything was the sound of Benny Goodman playing 1 o'clock jump and the taste of blood running down the back of her throat. Have you seen Brodigan? Bobby thought. He is an old mongrel, but we love him. Have you seen? She had pulled her shades before lying down, and the room was very dark. He took another step, then stopped again by the table with the mirror where she sometimes sat to do her makeup. Her purse was there. Bobby thought of Ted hugging him. The hug Bobby had wanted, needed so badly. Ted stroking his back, cupping the curve of his skull. "When I touch, I pass on a kind of window," Ted had told him while they were coming back from Bridgeport in the cab. And now, standing by his mother's makeup table with his fists clenched, Bobby looked tentatively through that window. Into his mother's mind. He caught a glimpse of her coming home on the train, huddling by herself, looking into 10,000 backyards between Providence and Harwich so as few people as possible would see her face. He saw her spying the bright green key fob on the shelf by the tooth glass as Carol slipped into her old blouse, saw her walking Carol home, asking her questions the whole way, one after another, firing them like bullets out of a machine gun. Carol, too shaken and worn out to dissemble, had answered them all. Bobby saw his mother walking, limping, down to Commonwealth Park, heard her thinking, if only some good could be salvaged from this nightmare, if only some good, anything good. He saw her sit on a bench in the shade, and then get up after a while, walking towards Spicer's for a headache powder and a knee-high to wash it down with before going back home. And then just before leaving the park, Bobby saw her spy something tacked to a tree. These somethings were tacked up all over town. She might have passed a couple on her way to the park, so lost in thought she never noticed. Once again, Bobby felt like a passenger in his own body. No more than that. He watched his hand reach out, saw two fingers, the ones that would bear the yellow smudges of the heavy smoker in another few years, make a scissoring motion and catch what was protruding from the mouth of her purse. Bobby pulled the paper free, unfolded it, and read the first two lines in the faint light from the bedroom doorway. Have you seen Brodigan? He is an old mongrel, but we love him. His eyes skipped halfway down to the lines that had no doubt riveted his mother and driven every other thought from her head. We will pay a very large reward. Here was the something good she had been wishing for, hoping for, praying for. Here was a very large reward. And had she hesitated? Had the thought, wait a minute, my kid loves that old bastard ball, even crossed her mind? Nah, you couldn't hesitate because life was full of Don Bidermans and life wasn't fair. Bobby left the room on tiptoe with the poster still in his hand, mincing away from her in big, soft steps, freezing when a board creaked under his feet, then moving on. Behind him, his mom's muttering talk had subsided into low snores again. Bobby made it into the living room and closed her door behind him, holding the knob at full cock until the door was shut tight, not wanting the latch to click. Then he hurried across to the phone, aware only now that he was away from her that his heart was racing and his throat was lined with a taste like old pennies. Any vestige of hunger had vanished. He picked up the telephone's handset, looked around quickly and narrowly to make sure his mom's door was still shut, then dialed without referring to the poster. The number was burned into his mind. Housatonic 58337. There was only silence when he finished dialing. That wasn't surprising either, because there was no Housatonic exchange in Harwich. And if he felt cold all over, except for his balls and the soles of his feet, which were strangely hot, that was just because he was afraid for Ted, that was all. Just, there was a stone-like click as Bobby was about to put the handset down, and then a voice said, "Yeah." "It's Spider-Man," Bobby thought wildly. "Cripes, it's Spider-Man." "Yeah," the voice said again. "No, not Spider-Man's. Too low for Spider-Man's." But it was a Nimrod voice, no doubt about that, and as his skin temperature continued to plummet toward absolute zero, Bobby knew that the man on the other end of the line had some sort of yellow coat in his wardrobe. Suddenly his eyes grew hot and the backs of them began itching. "Is this the Sagamore family?" was what he'd meant to ask, and if whoever answered the phone said yes, he'd meant to beg them to leave Ted alone, to tell them he, Bobby Garfield, would do something for them if they'd just leave Ted be. He'd do anything they asked, but now that his chance had arrived, he could say nothing. Until this moment, he still hadn't completely believed in the low men. No, something was on the other end of the line. Something that had nothing in common with life as Bobby Garfield understood it. "Bobby?" the voice said, and there was a kind of insinuate pleasure in the voice, a sensuous recognition. "Bobby," it said again, this time without the question mark. The flecks began to stream across Bobby's vision, the living room of the apartment suddenly filled with black snow. "Please," Bobby whispered. He gathered all of his will and forced himself to finish. "Please let him go."
"No can do," the voice from the void told him. "He belongs to the king. Stay away, Bobby. Don't interfere. Ted's our dog, if you don't want to be our dog, too. Stay away." Click.
Bobby held the telephone to his ear a moment longer, needing to tremble and too cold to do it. The itching behind his eyes began to fade, though, and the threads falling across his vision began to merge into the general murk. At last he took the phone away from the side of his head, started to put it down, then paused. There were dozens of little red circles on the handset's perforated earpiece. It was as if the voice of the thing on the other end had caused the telephone to bleed. Panting, in soft and rapid little whimpers, Bobby put it back in its cradle and went into his room.
"Don't interfere," the man at the Sagamore family number had told him. "Ted's our dog."
But Ted wasn't a dog. He was a man, and he was Bobby's friend. "She could have told them where he'll be tonight," Bobby thought. "I think Carol knew. If she did, and if she told Mom..." Bobby grabbed the bike fund jar
He took all the money out of it and left the apartment. He considered leaving his mother a note, but didn't. She might call Housatonic 58337 again if he did and tell the Nimrod with a low voice what her Bobbio was doing. That was one reason for not leaving a note. The other was that if he could warn Ted in time, he'd go with him. Now Ted would have to let him come, and if the low men killed him or kidnapped him, well, those things were almost the same as running away, weren't they? Bobby took a final look around the apartment, and as he listened to his mother snore, he felt an involuntary tugging at his heart and mind. Ted was right. In spite of everything, he loved her still. If there was Ka, then loving her was part of his. Still, he hoped to never see her again. "Bye, Mom," Bobby whispered. A minute later, he was running down Broad Street Hill into the deepening gloom, one hand wrapped around the wad of money in his pocket so none of it would bounce out. Ten. Down there again. Corner boys. Low men in yellow coats. The payout. He called a cab from the pay telephone at Spicer's, and while he waited for his ride, he took down a Brodigan Lost Pet poster from the outside bulletin board. He also removed an upside-down file card advertising a 57 Rambler for sale by the owner. He crumpled them up and threw them in the trash barrel by the door, not even bothering to look back over his shoulder to see if old man Spicer, whose foul temper was legendary among the kids on the west side of Harwich, had seen him do it. The Sigsby twins were down here now. Their jump ropes put aside so they could play hopscotch. Bobby walked over to them and observed the shapes. A star, a comet, a crescent moon, drawn beside the grid. He got down on his knees, and Dinah Sigsby, who'd been about to toss her stone at the seven, stopped to watch him. Diane put her grimy fingers over her mouth and giggled. Ignoring them, Bobby used both of his hands to sweep the shapes into chalk blurs. When he was done, he stood up and dusted his hands off. The pole light in Spicer's tiny three-car parking lot came on. Bobby and the girls grew sudden shadows much longer than they were. "Why'd you do that, stupid old Bobby Garfield?" Dinah asked. "They were pretty." "They're bad luck," Bobby said. "Why aren't you at home?" Not that he didn't have a good idea. It was flashing in their heads like the beer signs in Spicer's window. "Mom and Daddy having a fight," Diane said. "She says he got a girlfriend." She laughed, and her sister joined in, but their eyes were frightened. They reminded Bobby of the Litlands in Lord of the Flies. "Go home before it gets all the way dark," he said. "Mama said stay out," Dinah told him. "Then she's stupid, and so is your father. Go on." They exchanged a glance, and Bobby understood that he had scared them even more. He didn't care. He watched them grab their jump ropes and go running up the hill. 5 minutes later, the cab he'd called pulled into the parking area beside the store, its headlights fanning the gravel.
"Huh," the cabbie said. "I don't know about taking any little kid to Bridgeport after dark, even if you do got the fare."
"It's okay," Bobby said, getting him back. If the cabbie meant to throw him out now, he'd better have a crowbar in the trunk to do it with. "My grandfather will meet me." But not at the corner pocket. Bobby'd already decided he wasn't going to pull up to the place in a checker. Someone might be watching for him.
"At the Woe Fat Noodle Company. That's on Narragansett Avenue."
The corner pocket was also on Narragansett. He hadn't remembered the street name, but had found it easily enough in the yellow pages after calling the cab. The driver had started to back out into the street. Now he paused again.
"Nasty Gansett Street? Christ, that's no part of town for a kid, not even in broad daylight."
"My grandfather's meeting me," Bobby repeated. "He said to tip you half a rock, you know, 50 cents. For a moment, the cabbie teetered. Bobby tried to think of some other way to persuade him and couldn't think of a thing. Then the cabbie sighed, dropped his flag, and got rolling. As they passed his building, Bobby looked to see if there were any lights on in their apartment. There weren't, not yet. He sat back and waited for Harwich to drop behind him. The cabbie's name was Roy Delois. It was on his taxi meter. He didn't say a word on the ride to Bridgeport. He was sad because he'd had to take Pete to the vet and have him put down. Pete had been 14. That was old for a collie. He had been Roy Delois's only real friend. Go on, big boy, eat that up. It's on me, Roy Deloyce would say when he fed Pete. He said the same thing every night. Roy Deloyce was divorced. Sometimes he went to a stripper club in Hartford. Bobby could see ghost images of the dancers, most of whom wore feathers and long white gloves. The image of Pete was sharper. Roy Deloyce had been okay, coming back from the vets, but when he saw Pete's empty dish in the pantry at home, he had broken down crying. They passed the William Penn Grill. Bright light streamed from every window, and the street was lined with cars on both sides for three blocks, but Bobby saw no crazy DeSotos or other cars that felt like thinly disguised living creatures. The backs of his eyes didn't itch. There were no black threads. The cab crossed the canal bridge, and then they were down there. Loud, Spanish-sounding music played from apartment houses with fire escapes zigzagging up the sides like iron lightning. Clusters of young men with gleaming comb-back hair stood on some street corners. Clusters of laughing girls stood on others. When the checker stopped at a red light, a brown-skinned man sauntered over, hips seeming to roll like oil in gabardine slacks that hung below the waistband of his bright white underwear shorts, and offered to wash the cabbie's windshield with a filthy rag he held. Roy Deloyce shook his head curtly and squirted away. The instant the light changed. "Goddamn specs," he said. "They should be barred from the country. Ain't we got enough niggers of our own?" Narragansett Street looked different at night. Slightly scarier, slightly more fabulous as well. Locksmiths, check-cashing services, a couple of bars spilling out laughter and jukebox music, and guys with beer bottles in their hands, rods, guns. And yes, just beyond rods and next to the shop selling special souvenirs, the Whoa Fat Noodle Company. From here it couldn't be more than four blocks to the corner pocket. It was only 8 o'clock. Bobby was in plenty of time. When Roy Deloyce pulled up to the curb, there was 80 cents on his meter. Add in a 50-cent tip, and you were talking about a big hole in the old bike fund, but Bobby didn't care. He was never going to make a big deal out of money the way she did. If he could warn Ted before the low men could grab him, Bobby would be content to walk forever. "I don't like leaving you off here," Roy Deloyce said. "Where's your grandpa?" "Oh, he'll be right along," Bobby said, striving for a cheerful tone and almost making it. It was really amazing what you could do when your back was against the wall. He held out the money. For a moment, Roy Deloyce hesitated instead of taking the dough, thought about driving him back to Spicer's, but if the kid's not telling the truth about his grandpa, what's he doing down here, Roy Deloyce thought. He's too young to want to get laid. "I'm fine," Bobby sent back. And yes, he thought he could do that too, a little anyway. "Go on, stop worrying, I'm fine." Roy Deloyce finally took the crumpled dollar and the trio of dimes. "This is really too much," he said. "My grandpa told me to never be stingy like some people are," Bobby said, getting out of the cab. "Maybe you ought to get a new dog, you know, a puppy." Roy Deloyce was maybe 50, but surprise made him look much younger.
"How?"
Then Bobby heard him decide he didn't care how. Roy Deloyce put his cab in gear and drove away, leaving Bobby in front of the Whoa Fat Noodle Company. He stood there until the cab's taillights disappeared, then began walking slowly in the direction of the corner pocket, pausing long enough to look through the dusty window of special souvenirs. The bamboo blind was up, but the only special souvenir on display was a ceramic ashtray in the shape of a toilet. There was a groove for a cigarette in the seat. "Park your butt" was written on the tank. Bobby considered this quite witty. But not much of a window display. He had sort of been hoping for items of a sexual nature, especially now that the sun had gone down. He walked on, past B-Port Printing, and Shoes Repaired While You Wait, and Snappy Cards for All Occasions. Up ahead was another bar, more young men on the corner, and the sound of the Cadillacs black slacks make you cool, Daddy-O. When you put 'em on, you're raring to go. Bobby crossed the street, trotting with his shoulders hunched, his head down and his hands in his pockets. Across from the bar was an out-of-business restaurant with a tattered awning still overhanging its soaped windows. Bobby slipped into its shadow and kept going, shrinking back once when someone shouted and a bottle shattered. When he reached the next corner, he recrossed Nasty Gansett Street on the diagonal, getting back to the side the corner pocket was on. As he went, he tried to tune his mind outward and pick up some sense of Ted. But there was nothing. Bobby wasn't all that surprised. If he had been Ted, he would have gone someplace like the Bridgeport Public Library, where he could hang around without being noticed. Maybe after the library closed, he'd get a bite to eat, kill a little more time that way. Eventually, he'd call another cab and come to collect his money. Bobby didn't think he was anywhere close yet, but he kept listening for him. He was listening so hard that he walked into a guy without even seeing him. "Hey, cabron," the guy said, laughing, but not in a nice way. Hands grabbed Bobby's shoulders and held him. "Where was you think you going, Putino?" Bobby looked up and saw four young guys, what his mom would have called corner boys, standing in front of a place called Bodega. They were Puerto Ricans, he thought, and all wearing sharp creased slacks, black boots with pointed toes poked out from beneath their pants cuffs. They were also wearing blue silk jackets with the word Diablos written on the back. The eye was a devil's pitchfork. Something seemed familiar about the pitchfork, but Bobby had no time to think about that. He realized with a sinking heart that he had wandered into four members of some gang. "I'm sorry," he said in a dry voice. "Really, excuse me." He pulled back from the hands holding his shoulders and started around the guy. He made just a single step before one of the others grabbed him. "Where you going, Tio?" this one asked. "Where you going, Tio mio?" Bobby pulled free, but the fourth guy pushed him back at the second. The second guy grabbed him again, not so gently this time. It was like being surrounded by Harry and his friends, only worse.
"You got any money, Tio?" asked the third guy. "'Cause this is a toll road, you know."
They all laughed and moved in closer. Bobby could smell their spicy aftershaves, their hair tonics, his own fear. He couldn't hear their mind voices, but did he need to? They were probably going to beat him up and steal his money. If he was lucky, that was all they'd do, but he might not be lucky.
"Little boy..."
The fourth guy almost sang. He reached out a hand, gripped the bristles of Bobby's crew cut, and pulled hard enough to make tears well up in Bobby's eyes.
"Little muchacho, what you got for money, huh? How much of the good old dinero? You have something, and we're going to let you go. You have nothing, and we're going to bust your balls. Leave him alone, Juan."
They looked around, Bobby too, and here came a fifth guy, also wearing a Diablos jacket, also wearing slacks with a sharp crease. He had on loafers instead of pointy-toed boots, and Bobby recognized him at once. It was the young man who had been playing the Frontier Patrol game in the corner pocket when Ted was making his bet. No wonder that pitchfork shape had looked familiar. It was tattooed on the guy's hand. His jacket had been tied inside out around his waist. "No club jacket in here," he'd told Bobby, but he wore the sign of the Diablos just the same. Bobby tried to look into the newcomer's mind and saw only dim shapes. His ability was fading again, as it had on the day Mrs. Gerber took them to Savin Rock. Shortly after they left McQuown's stand at the end of the midway, it had been gone. This time, the winkle had lasted longer, but it was going now, all right.
"Hey, Dee," said the boy who had pulled Bobby's hair. "We're just going to shake this little guy out a little, make him pay his way across Diablo turf." "Not this one," Dee said. "I know him. He's my compadre." "You look like a pansy uptown boy to me," said the one who had called Bobby cabron and putino. "I teach him a little respect." "He don't need no lesson from you," Dee said. "You want one from me, mozo?"
Mozo stepped back, frowning, and took a cigarette out of his pocket. One of the others snapped him a light, and Dee drew Bobby a little further down the street. "What are you doing down here, amigo?" he asked, gripping Bobby's shoulder with the tattooed hand. "You stupid to be down here alone, and you fucking loco to be down here at night alone." "I can't help it," Bobby said. "I have to find the guy I was with yesterday. His name is Ted. He's old and thin and pretty tall. He walks kind of hunched over like Boris Karloff, you know, the guy in the scary movies." "I know Boris Karloff, but I don't know no fucking Ted," Dee said. "I don't ever see him, man. You got to get out of here." "I have to go to the corner pocket," Bobby said. I was just there, Disa. I didn't see no guy like Boris Karloff.
It's still too early. I think you'll be there between 9:30 and 10. I have to be there when he comes because there's some men after him. They wear yellow coats and white shoes. They drive big, flashy cars. One of them's a purple DeSoto. And Dee grabbed him and spun him against the door of a pawn shop.